Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast Seminar. Our guest today is His Royal Highness, Prince Philip Karadjordjevich. He is the son of Crown Prince Alexander, who is the son of King Peter, who was the last king of Yugoslavia. And he is currently moved back to Belgrade. And also, he has come out publicly as an avid Bitcoiner. Now, if you've been listening here frequently, our very first episode, our very first seminar in this podcast was a discussion of monarchy. And I made the case for why I think monarchy is a superior form of government to democracy, and why I think a Bitcoin world is likely to lead to more monarchies and fewer democracies. Up until now, I hadn't found any Prince Charming who would come and support this vision. But then out of nowhere, a few weeks ago, Prince Philip was on Serbian TV and he explained that he is a Bitcoiner. And I thought I must talk to him. And I've chatted with Prince Philip before, and we seem to see eye to eye on the relationship between Bitcoin and monarchy. And so I thought this would be an amazing topic to discuss. Why Bitcoin it makes sense for monarchs and why monarchy makes sense for Bitcoin. Like many of our episodes, obviously this is going to get a lot of people's knickers in a twist. So, you know, if you're not a fan of monarchy, perhaps you might want to switch off. But, you know,
if you claim to be a fan of democracy, you might want to actually just sit and listen and see if you can find something that is compelling here. So, Prince Philip, Your Highness, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Saif Din. It's a great pleasure and honor to be here. That was quite a nice introduction.
Thank you. Tell us a little bit more about your personal background, your life outside of royalty and outside of Bitcoin, and how that led you to Bitcoin.
So I used to live in London before I moved to Serbia. I was actually, start from the beginning, when I was born in America in 1982. My older brother Peter was born in Chicago. My twin brother and I have a twin, were born in Washington and lived there for a couple of years. My parents sadly separated. We moved, my brothers and I moved to Seville, Spain, Sevilla, where we spent 2 or 3 years there until, well, there was a decision made that we moved to London to live with my father and my stepmother. And that was very difficult, living with my stepmother. And well, she, you can imagine, it's a bit of that usual tale of the evil stepmother, but it's kind of true. I don't mind being open about this. Being separated from your mother was not easy from such a young age. Yes, we do go back to see my mother every during holidays, but not easy. We went to school in the UK. I went to boarding schools and then later for secondary education. And then I went to university in London, studied Hispanic studies because I speak Spanish fluently. And it's a very interesting topic. It's a very interesting subject. And then I got involved into the financial world. I was working for an Icelandic bank, which sadly went under during the 2008 crisis because Iceland were highly leveraged. And I decided to go into hospitality, went to Switzerland, Lausanne, to the hotel school there. And then left, worked in a hotel, but decided to go back to finance because the money is better. All the while, I moved to Cyprus for 2 years, then moved back to London to work for an asset manager. And all the while, my life is always like thinking, this world is not working right. This world, something's definitely wrong with it. I've always thought that from a young age. I remember speaking to my mother when I was a kid and says, what's the point of voting? they all just do the same thing. I don't think she wasn't very happy with me about that, but that's the way I thought from a very young age. And that that led me to 2017. I think it was late, it was never too late. 2017 is when the year I met my wife and the year I met Bitcoin.
same is true for me, incidentally. Yeah. Same week.
Same week. What a big week. And I married my wife the same year as I got into Bitcoin. But of course, I was distracted by the shitcoinery, as most of us do. And it wasn't until 2 years ago that I started to really see why Bitcoin is the only one. I joined Bitcoin Twitter. I have a dormant account that's been dormant since 2010. So I logged back into it and I started going around Bitcoin Twitter and I was like, wow, these guys are making a lot of sense. The maxis, that is, of course. There was a lot of intelligent stuff being said, a lot of funny stuff, a lot of great memes, some passion, I would say, to put it lightly. And that really made me open my eyes up. And I was like, yeah, I get it now. I really get it. This is it, you know. And then I soon after that, in beginning of 2021, I dropped all my shit coins and I was, you know, went full Bitcoin. I bought your book, The Bitcoin Standard, which was an excellent read, one of the best reads of my life, a heavy read as well, but a must read for anyone who wants to get into Bitcoin or who is into Bitcoin. And yeah, that's it up until now. Here I am speaking to the likes of you, which I'm very, very honored to be.
The honors are all mine. And this just confirms an observation that I've often made, that you know, people sometimes like to mock Bitcoiners on Twitter, saying, well, you know, it's just a bunch of anonymous losers probably typing from their mom's basements. But I've traveled a lot and I've spoken in many places and met Bitcoiners all over. You know, I get invited to speak, and it's a very common occurrence that I'll be at some after event after I give a speech, and then a few people will come and introduce themselves to me, and you know, we get on a good rapport, and then they'll tell me, by the way, you know, I know you from Twitter. This is my Anon account. And they'll show me their Anon account. And, you know, it's one of these, you know, cat or who knows what profile picture with 350 followers. But the guy would be, you know, some hedge fund manager that manages billions of dollars of assets. And they'll meet another Anon account with 550 followers who will also be some major hedge fund manager. And they might make a business deal out of this meeting. And I think, you know, a lot of Bitcoiners want to stay anonymous, and it gives the impression that they're just, you know, random people. But the fact that you have an anonymous account, well, suggests to me that it's a lot of interesting people there, you know, princes and hedge fund managers.
I've got to say, I don't like the idea of anonymous accounts, really. It just doesn't really work. I don't like the fact that I'm an anonymous account, but if I started putting my name there, I would get unwanted attention. So I think for people who don't have like such attention grabbing names, like if I started Philip Carroll Georgia, it's Prince Philip and stuff, people would be like, okay, well, that's Prince Philip. And I like to follow and comment. Well, I don't comment too much, but I like a lot of stuff that could be seen as quite controversial, which is stuff that I believe is correct because I'm a Bitcoiner and I see through the BS. But it's not to bring unwanted attention for now.
Yeah. But, you know, with time, it's becoming, I agree with you, I think it's becoming less and less justified to have an anonymous account. You know, we have everybody from 15-year-old kids to billionaires posting with their name, talking about their interest in Bitcoin. And I think, you know, unless you're Satoshi Nakamoto, or unless maybe I can see how if you're one of the Bitcoin core developers, you might not want the attention because it might bring you legal troubles. I think at this point, you know, there are millions of people that are open about the fact that they're into Bitcoin. And I think I don't really see the excuse for anybody else to be anonymous. And I'm glad that you're now public and open about it in your public profile.
Yes, it's great because as a prince, I have a voice. It may not be the biggest voice in the world, but it's a voice. It's a voice in my region. The Karadjordjevic family here, the dynasty, is very important to Serbia. We, my great grandfather, that's four greats, was Karadjordje, who led the first uprising against the Ottomans. So he liberated Serbia from Ottoman rule. And that is the day that's marked as the Serbian National Day, the 15th of February, Sretan Dan, when he had he was a general. He was from a modest background. He's from a humble background. He became a relatively successful livestock merchant, a pig farmer, I guess, as well. And he was very charismatic, and he was a general. He led that first uprising, and since then, that's created the Karadjordjevic dynasty. Karadjordje and Vich is son of Karadjordje. So I have, I have an important voice, and I like to think that my voice is also a voice for other people, that I'm able to amplify the voices of other people, because I really am concerned about what's going on, not only in Serbia, but around the world. But in Serbia, there's still a lot of problems. It's not a perfect country like any country right now, but I want Serbia to be healthy, and I want Serbia to be free. And if Serbia isn't healthy and free, I feel somewhat not healthy and free as well. So I like to amplify their voices and make themselves be heard as well as myself. And now since I've found, since Bitcoin's come into the equation, I'm really happy and I'm relieved that I was able to get those 3 minutes of that big Bitcoin blurb on Ivan Ivanovich show, which has opened a new world to me completely. And this is a world, a path that I'm so proud and honored to be going down now. to try and educate the world about the problems of the monetary system that we live in, the Keynesian monetarist system that we sadly live in, and the fiat problems, basically. That's how this joke of a monetary system leads to so many problems of our lives.
Yeah, I think this is becoming more and more of an obligation, I think, for Bitcoiners. If you really care about the problems that Bitcoin solves, I think the best thing that you can do is put your face and name out there. And we need more and more people from all walks of life. Having royalty, obviously, is great, but also having just random people from all over, you know, children, adults, billionaires, plumbers, everybody saying, you know, I'd like to have a form of money that I can save in. And I think Bitcoin is that form of money. And I think this is really probably, it might be more important for Bitcoin's security in the long term than any kind of technical issues, because the more people are open about it, you know, the fact that we have Paris Hilton publicly being open about it, putting her laser eyes on her profile, the fact that we have Tom Brady and Stefan de Vrij and all kinds of athletes and popular people is going to make it, I think, harder for governments to really crack down on Bitcoin. The genie is out of the bottle. And so the more people come out, the bigger the genie is, I think.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, people in Serbia that have come out, not many, actually. I think I'm the first high-profile figure here in Serbia. I'm proud of that. I mean, there's always a sense of pride when you're the first. And I'm also proud of the fact that I think I might be the first royal to come out. And I hope I'm not the last. So, yeah, let's go.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the royal family in Liechtenstein have said that they have invested in Bitcoin a few years ago, but they're not very public about it. They're not on Bitcoin Twitter posting with the plebs yet, at least. But hopefully you can put in a word and get them to do it.
What I recently learned is that they like to follow a bit of Austrian economics, and they're quite libertarian when it comes down to it.
Very true, yes. In fact, they've invited me to one of their conferences a few years ago. I went to Vaduz, and they had an Austrian economics conference. They have one every year, named after Gottfried von Haberler. It was a very nice event, and I met very interesting people.
Well, that's a potential Bitcoin standard nation there. I think I've discussed this before, is that, you know, I believe smaller nations will be easier to orange pill, so to speak, because they have less divisions within their borders, and they can enact these changes much quicker than the larger, more complex countries.
Yes, very true. In fact, the example of El Salvador, it is a small nation, and in a sense, it's almost like a monarchy. Democracy fans aren't very fond of President Bukele because they call him authoritarian, but when El Salvador had a thriving democracy with the rotation of power, it had very violent conflict, and government was there to serve the interests of the ruling elites. And now the current president has an enormous amount of legitimate support among the population. His approval numbers are over 85% consistently, which is pretty astonishing and pretty royal almost in its regard. The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddin.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats.
Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with a nice colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Yeah, that's great that he was able to turn around El Salvador, not just with the Bitcoin, but it was one of the murder capitals of the world. Violence there was ridiculous. So it's a great story. Now, of course, you can argue, as you said, that you know he can be seen as authoritarian, but you know, I guess you needed that at that time in order to enact these changes.
Yeah. So tell us, what is your case for monarchy? So we live in a world in which everybody thinks democracy is the best thing. And democracy is it's an unquestionable thing. Everybody who wants to, I mean, we're at the point where when people want to say something is good, they say that it's democratic, even though it might not even be democratic.
Doesn't mean that.
Yeah, but it's just become this word that means good. So obviously it must have been tough growing up as a royal in this time. And how do you answer the haters? What is your case for monarchy?
Yes, so firstly, what monarchy means to me is monarchy means freedom. And democracy actually does not equal freedom, as we can list many examples later on. But monarchy to me means that this is something I learned, especially quite recently by speaking to yourself, is that it has a natural way of seeing low time preference, of doing things with low time preference. When you run a prosperous and functioning society, we're using low time preference, you can do things. You do things for that benefit the future for your children. I'm talking about being a monarch. Say if I was king, I would focus on not taking wealth from the future, from the present, because you want to keep that wealth for the future, for your children and your children's children and children, and so on. It's a very long game. I mean, with democracies, you have that insecurity, the uncertainness you have, because leaders are only in power for a few years. They come and go. You have elections every four or five years. And that means that their way of doing things is with a high time preference. They'll be looking to secure wealth and their position by pondering what they can at that time. And they're only really thinking about how to keep that job essentially for the next election, but they're not going to be there forever. And so that process repeats over and over and over again. I mean, a monarch is not really concerned about what they're going to take. What about how much to take? Because they have enough, really. So that creates this stability. You gave in your first Bitcoin episode a really good example, the analogy of the hunt. It's an example of hunting versus herding. The analogy. I mean, I recommend listeners to go listen to the first episode. We might touch on a few things here, but it's a really good listen.
In the situation of a monarchy, the king expects to be there and expects their kids and their grandkids, you know, 10 generations down the line, he wants to hand over a monarchy that is functional, that is wealthy, that is strong, that can resist outside enemies. And in order to do that, you want to have your people be wealthy, strong, and you want them to be loyal, and you want them to be happy and wealthy. And so... The the focus of the monarch, because they expect to rule for life and then they expect their children and their descendants to rule for essentially eternity, is to try and optimize for eternity. So that leads to a very low time preference. Every time a monarch carries out an action, and I think if you start thinking of the actions of monarchies from this regard, you start seeing... You start seeing that they make a lot more sense this way. Everything is geared towards the long-term future, whereas in the situation of a democracy, doesn't matter how legitimate you are as a president, you're only there for 4 years, 8 years, 10, 15, 20 years, whatever it is. It's always uncertain. You know, even if you last 20 years, you did not expect to last 20 years when you got started. And you can't expect a smooth transition to your children. You know, even in places where we see democratic presidents turn authoritarian and hand over the reins to their children, it's never very smooth and easy. It's always highly uncertain. It always includes a lot of conflict. And so, therefore, you're optimizing for grab and run, basically. You've got 4 years in office.
And grab and run.
Yeah, this is your chance to secure your family forever, because most likely your kids aren't going to be there. So you want to get them the goods now. You know, you want to give them land. You want to take other people's lands. You want to give them monopoly rights on the distribution of certain goods or the other. So all of these opportunities to benefit from your position of power in a democracy are far more pronounced, and therefore far more pressing, and therefore presidents everywhere. I mean, it's amazing that people still believe in democracy, because it doesn't matter where you look. You know, in examples of democratic countries, you always see corruption. You always see presidents abusing their power, and it's just natural. All the idea of democracy is against human nature. It presents that you can have somebody in power who's going to not care about their own well-being and not care about their children's well-being. We're going to have a popularity contest, and the person who's going to win the popularity contest is going to be just a complete, to win a popularity contest, you have to be extremely megalomaniac. And then to imagine that that person is going to be completely selfless and turn around and not think about their own benefits and their own children's interests, and just sacrifice themselves for public office in exchange for a very low salary, is completely idealistic, nonsensical, in my opinion. They are going to take advantage of their position, and they're going to do it with a very high time preference, with the inclination to get it done quickly.
You're right in saying that democracies, when the election process is... And this only doesn't go in the election in election process for voting a leader or politician, but also for companies. And so it tends to benefit those who act in a sociopathic or psychopathic way. And those are the ones who actually tend to make it to the top quite often. And they're the ones who understand that they're not there for long. And they do what they can to benefit themselves. Also, those people who sit around thinking, yes, you know, the democracy that I'm participating in, that I'm voting in, I'm electing a good leader, they'll do what's right for me and everything. So they don't really stand up or move forwards to make these changes. They are too honest and too nice, because humans are honest and nice. The majority of humans are good. They act in good faith, but then it's those people who are those sociopaths and psychopaths, which see everywhere. You know, you can just use your gut instinct to see them all over the place right now in the news, are the ones who make it to the top, and they don't have those people's interest in mind. And this is what the fiat system and the democracy system benefits. It helps those people, and this is why Bitcoin, the monarchy, changes that, I mean, and it helps the people, helps people being honest, because that's what a good functioning society works. If people are honest with each other and honest with other people, and you have an honest monetary system where you can't change the rules, you can't change the protocol, you can't change it unless it's done by consensus, where you know that 1 + 1 equals two and not $1 plus $1 equals as many dollars as you want, as you want for the people in charge, then if you work by rules that you can't change, and everybody will end up being much more, let's say, honest, as I was saying, and there wouldn't be this situation we are in today, these horrible outcomes that we have.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, ultimately, it was being a libertarian that brought me toward becoming and appreciating monarchy. I still consider myself an anarchist, and I would rather live in an anarchist society than a monarchist society. But I think, realistically, you're far more likely to have more freedom if you live under a monarchist society than a democratic society, because ultimately, what you really want from government, from any government, or what you really ideally want is just the security of property. I think anarchy is just about the security of property and the ability of an individual to own their property and expect to continue to own it for many generations. If you have that, then you have people developing a lower time preference, then you have people investing for the future. If you don't have that, people's time preference rises. And the reality is, people's properties are far more secure under monarchy Correct. Than under democracy, because under democracy, as we said, the ruler has an incentive to pillage and grab and go, or smash and grab if you want. And under monarchy, he wants the country to prosper in the long run. So you get the security of property. Then, of course, you also have the perverse selection. And I think one other aspect of it is that democracy has... It legitimates the idea of government. It convinces people with this extremely dangerous idea that government is us, that we are government. They talk about their government as if it is we. And I think this is obviously delusional, but it's not just funny delusional, it's disastrous, catastrophic delusional. When you think that the government works for you, and when you think that, you know, I voted, therefore these people should do what I do, you're really getting scammed in a very, very brutal way, because they don't work for you. They work for themselves. And it is only because of this legitimacy that you give them that they are able to basically exploit you and take advantage of you very, very, very Yes. heavily. And on the one hand, it gives people this idea that they legitimate government, so they start expecting their government to do more, which you see in democracies much more than you see in monarchies. If you travel to a monarchy generally, people don't have as much of this sense of entitlement where, you know, why isn't the government doing this for me? Why isn't the government doing that for me? In monarchies, people tend to mind their own business and take care of their own stuff and not expect the government to force feed them things. And that Right. works out much better, because you spend your time taking care of yourself. Everybody spends their time taking care of themselves. Everybody minds their own garden. And you end up with a much nicer society than a society in which everybody wants to be in charge of centrally planning everybody else's gardens. And then the flip side of this is that everybody ends up in conflict. This is the problem with democracy. Everybody wants to be king, and everybody's engaged in an eternal conflict of who's going to be king. Is it going to be me? Is it going to be you? How do we sort this out? And then, you know, people don't mind their own gardens because they're too busy fighting over who's going to mind everybody's gardens. So none of the gardens get tended. You see this so many societies that have spent a lot of time suffering in, you know, the lawlessness of democracy.
The other thing is democracies have those interests, the small small groups or individuals like lobbyists or very rich individuals who help the leader get into power, and then so the leader has a debt towards those groups, those lobbyists or rich people, and they end up focusing on one industry or one thing. So they end up forgetting about the whole country. It just creates divisions, really. At the end of the day, democracy. At the end of the day, when people vote, there's always some people who are not happy with the leaders, and so there's always some people just saying, "Oh no, we were left out." And I'm not part of those, with that political party or this party. And over time, that just creates more divisions. And it's easy to for the state to control people when they're so divided. And democracies over time create too many lines, really. And like we can see today, this what it's come down to, really. We get this whole woke mentality being born from that, I guess. It's not nice. It's not pretty.
Yeah, this is the continuation of it. It's just, and it fits perfectly with the fiat idea because, you know, when you have this giant pot of gold, figurative gold that is at the fiat standard, that is just, if you win this popularity contest, you get to print money for everybody and you get to take money from anybody because, you know, you control the central bank, you control the banking system. You can confiscate all of the money of your enemies and you can give all the money that you want to your friends. I mean, simply having that is just a recipe for disaster. And I think the intertwining of democracy and fiat is very, very strong. And I think it's, you know, the rise of fiat came with World War One, which is also the time in which the monarchies of the world began to disappear. And this is, you know, one of my hobbies almost is to read about the history of countries with this lens. Like everybody's usually just thinking that, you know, there was this glorious revolution. Pick any country where they had a king, the king was evil, then there was the glorious revolution that was going to help the poor people become rich and it was going to make everything better. And then the Democrats and Republicans came into power and everything was supposed to be great, but then magically there was a bad guy who ended up taking over power and then we had a few genocides and a few million people dead and the country fought a bunch of wars and everything went to shit and we had hyperinflation. And people tend to think that, you know, it's amazing, like the way that they justify this and rationalize it. So, for instance, Russia, like you look at Russia under the Romanovs, the image that most people learn about Russia is that, oh, it was this backward society and the king was a despot and things were terrible. Well, I mean, clearly nobody's perfect. And I presume the king of Russia was, the Tsar of Russia was not perfect, but I think if you tallied all of the people that Tsar Nicholas had killed, it probably comes down to about one typical week of communist rule. I mean, all of the people that he killed under his entire reign is a weekend's work for Joseph Stalin. There's no comparison between the evil that happened before and after. And if you look, you know, the image that we have about Soviet, about Russia being this backward country, I mean, obviously it's a massive country and modern technology was just beginning to penetrate it. But it was still enormously advanced in many ways under the Russians. And we see these examples in many, many, many other places. So France, obviously, is the poster child for republicanism. Things didn't go very well after the fall of the monarchs, did it?
No, that's a good point you raise about with the technological advancement since World War II. I will use the case of Yugoslavia that people will look back at the monarchy and they know that the times were stable, times were prosperous there. But then you have that emotional connection to the other side of World War II, which was socialism, communism. But that's also was at the same time with the technological advancements of after the Second World War. So people think, oh, look, that they're advancing with the technology, things are good, they're prosperous, and actually Yugoslavia was. The Soviet Yugoslavia was, the socialist Yugoslavia was only prosperous because it was helped a lot by the Americans. They had a lot of American money going in there, but really it was a disaster project waiting to fail at some point. And the failure did come, of course, when Tito died. But even before him, the failure was happening. You got a lot of, especially when the Warsaw Pact fell apart. And that was the Warsaw Pact was created in retaliation to NATO being created, but the Warsaw Pact didn't last very long. And so once that disintegrated, Yugoslavia was not part of the Warsaw Pact. Yugoslavia was always trying to play between East and West. But when the Warsaw Pact fell apart, then there was no point of having Yugoslavia at that point. So the shift of the attention to Yugoslavia went away. Maybe rewinding back a little bit was that America and the West and the Brits wanted to support Tito over the monarchy because they didn't like that the monarchy was something that was becoming quite powerful and they couldn't control. So there was more. This is sad to say, but they went with Tito instead. And sadly, you know, my grandfather, when he was exiled, he went back to he was forced out his country. And he didn't take the gold, which a lot of people say he did, because we were left, we have nothing today. But he was back in the UK, and then slowly the UK was making him concede power by being there to Tito, because they wanted to support Tito, because Tito was an alliance with Russia. Anyway, so my point going to what you're talking before was, I mean, the Kingdom of Yugoslavia was comparatively speaking an empire in the 1930s. But the truth is simple, that the whole divide, there was that divided imperium, divide and conquer. It was easier to control. It was harder to control a highly functioning Yugoslav monarchy over a really weak, starving eight-part socialist federation of Tito of Yugoslavia. So this is the point, that a monarchy is much, much more stable, much stronger, whereas a failed project of socialist Yugoslavia was always going to be doomed. Even though people did say it was the good years, because it's the good years comparatively speaking to how it failed in the 80s and 90s, when inflation was rampant. And it disintegrated, the Yugoslavia disintegrated, and it fell into horrible war, as we all know.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's easy to have a boom if you borrow from the future and then you cause a catastrophe into the future. We see this in Correct. Many, many countries where, you know, these regimes come into power and essentially they pillage the public treasury that was built up over centuries by the monarchies, and they go on a consumption binge. And then people see that, you know, when this new glorious leader came in, we had all kinds of amazing things because he was spending to win his popularity contests. And then, you know, by the time he dies, sometimes before he dies, sometimes a few years after he dies, but, you know, 20, 30, 40 years later, the bill comes in. You've spent all of the saved capital, and now the population needs to deal with the inflation. And people think, the sad thing is people associate that, oh, well, you know, he died and then we had inflation because, you know, inflation just happens. It's like an earthquake. But as Mises says, inflation is a man-made thing. It's not a natural disaster. It's a man-made thing, and it's made over years and years and years. It's very, very thoroughly earned. Egypt is another example like this. People still associate the good years of Nasser. A lot of people have a nostalgia for the good years of President Nasser. But, you know, the real good years were under the king. I mean, in the 1930s and 40s, Cairo was one of the most beautiful cities in the world. The country was growing economically massively, and it was improving, and there was a real improvement in the country. And then the socialists took over, and then they had a massive consumption binge, you know, all of the fancy headlines. And Tito and Nasser were quite friendly with one another, part of the non-aligned movement. So it was a very similar story, you know, massive spending, and people think this is a great thing because we have all that spending, and then they don't connect the bill that comes for the spending after that with all of the spending that came before. They think we can just, if only Nasser had lived for another 100 years, we would have had all of that glory continue indefinitely. We could have kept on spending from the future indefinitely.
Yeah. Also, the tendency to then move to get help from the IMF is a problem. That's what happened in Yugoslavia as well.
Yes.
They borrowed a lot of money and ran up huge deficits. So
yeah. Incidentally, yeah. You know, you mentioned how the British were quite happy to support Tito. One of the very, very, very interesting history books I have read, probably one of the most influential history books I've ever read, and it's something that very rarely ever gets discussed, is a book by Anthony Sutton called Anthony Wall Sutton. Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. And it's an astonishing book because it shows he was a historian at Stanford. So this isn't some crazy tinfoil hat conspiracy theorist from his mom's basement. This was a professor at Stanford University who spent decades of his life meticulously documenting Russian history and the influence of British and American interests in the Russian Revolution. And what you suggest, I think, is extremely astute. In the same case, it's the same thing for Yugoslavia and for Russia. Americans and British interests were served by getting rid of the monarchs and replacing them with insecure, dependent revolutionary leaders who, let's face it, I mean, one of the interesting aspects of this fraud of these kind of leaders is, you know, they pretend to be nationalist leaders who are saving their country, but they're just regurgitating the moronic propaganda of American and British universities. Like, all of this Marxist garbage, all of this third world liberation, anti-imperialism nonsense that all of these supposedly revolutionary anti-imperialist leaders regurgitate, it all is manufactured in Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, and other universities of America that have been producing ridiculous propaganda for more than a century now. So there was a lot of financial and political support for taking down monarchies all over the world. And, you know, the beneficiaries from this are the same people who finance this very, very strongly. And I think it's coincided with fiat because, you know, the first thing that these monarchies always did was get rid of the gold. Sorry, the first thing that the revolutionary leaders always did was go off the gold standard, confiscate the central bank's gold, confiscate the people's gold, as they did in Russia. They confiscated the gold from all the churches, which was where most of the gold was. And of course, you know, you throw in the anti-religious propaganda there as well. And you take up the gold and you give people slave paper money. And then these thriving republics then just march on the road to hyperinflation. You know, it takes several
not even places like Russia. Sorry, not even places like Russia, but also in Britain, they got rid of that gold as well. They sent it to America, and then wasn't FDR took money, gold away from his people as well.
Yes.
So FDR this
did
is
that in Britain. Yeah.
Yeah.
FDR did it in the U.S.
Yeah. So everywhere. I mean, it's everywhere.
Indeed it is.
Yeah, that's what happened. You know, when Peter the First, my great grandfather came to power, he promised Serbia to move away from the German Austro-Hungarian sort of influence into more Franco-British imperial Russian alliance. I mean, that worked out quite well, but obviously that annoyed the Austro-Hungarians, and they sort of imposed sanctions on us. But he managed to, with a lot of hard work, and just shoot a few short years to move all the commerce to his new allies, and that was great. And Serbia actually did quite well under that. Serbia then became Yugoslavia under Alexander the First. But this alliance with Britain sort of stopped at some point when they saw Serbia becoming too strong, too independent with themselves, where they had people in Serbia becoming very rich. You had one family, the Savage family, who were in today's money was worth about $14 billion, which is quite incredible. And this created actually quite a strange situation where the people loved him because he created a sort of fake socialism for his workers, where he gave them free education, free housing, and free healthcare. But it worked to some extent there. It was just strange, you know, question marks around there. But this extra power that Serbia had was obviously annoying the other powers of Britain. And as you talked about, Britain wanted to have control, and they still do want, you know, around the world. And that's when the alliance sort of started to disintegrate. All happened at the same time when they started really pushing out the money printers around 1918.
Yep. Yeah, and also, you know, let's not just focus on the British and the Americans here. I think it's important in Anthony Sutton's book, it's also very clear that it wasn't just the British and the Americans who were working on bringing down the Tsar. It was also the Germans as well. You know, one of these kind of obvious facts that gets ignored is that Vladimir Lenin led the Bolshevik Revolution from Switzerland. Now, what exactly was he doing in Switzerland? Skiing? I doubt it. I mean, he was being financed by German bankers who wanted him to take out the Tsar because they wanted to get rid of Russia's, you know, they wanted to weaken Russia as part of the war. And this idea that, you know, these revolutionaries are out there to help the country and help the people of the country is... it becomes very, very fragile as a pretense to maintain once you see who finances them and then who benefits from them. And it's almost always the enemies of the country who benefit from the country being weakened.
Yes, that's the whole idea of revolution. You know, it really was led by... Revolutions always tend to be led by one individual. But I think the new revolution today is going to be led by us finally being individuals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, you know. I have my view of why I think Bitcoin fixes democracy by replacing it with monarchy is that I think ultimately democracies are always going to vote for fiat. They're always going to vote for more money printing, and they're always going to keep just getting going bankrupt more and more. I think you see it all over the world, even the kind of most you know, even the poster children for democracy are voting for extremely illiberal measures and extremely inflationary measures. They want the government to control everything. Now we see it with the COVID hysteria, where, you know, government needs to decide based on everybody's everybody needs to get tested, and the government needs to assign your rights based on your status and your medical status, and the government has infinite money to hand it out to everybody and stop people from working and just give them money. This kind of insanity, you know, it obviously can be maintained for a few years, but not for too long. And I think eventually democracies are just going to go bankrupt. No. And either... Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, no, I say they're doubling down now, tripling down now. With they have high, you know, inflation is rampant right now. But what are they going to do? Like, I just read that France is going to impose. They're going to hand out checks to the people who are suffering from inflation. So what? you're tackling inflation with inflation.
Yes, no, but yeah. It's even better than that. They're going to first give people money so that they can buy, so that they're going to throw more fire on the fuel.
There we go.
But also, they're going one step further. They're also cutting out the water that could turn down the fire, which is they're taxing the companies they're raising taxes on fuel companies, because, you know, clearly that's going to fix it, because clearly the whole thing is just fuel companies being evil conspiracists wanting to raise prices. You know, just suddenly, all of a sudden, the same fuel companies that went bankrupt 2 years ago, now they have decided to take revenge by raising prices. And so if we tax them and we take their money and we prevent them from investing, we take away money that they would have invested in building infrastructure to make fuel, and we take that money and we give it to genius government clowns like President Macron and Elizabeth Warren in the United States. We give them the money instead so that they can hand it out to win their popularity contests. Then the prices are going to drop.
Exactly.
That's democracy for you.
it's a complete clown behavior. It's a crazy world.
It is. And I think, you know, Bitcoin, if you've been in Bitcoin, you know that Bitcoin favors the low time preference. Bitcoin favors people who can think long term. And I think naturally, you know, people like you, monarchs, are just going to be very inclined to this. You view life in terms of, you know, you've got a history of family, a family history that extends centuries back, and you think further centuries ahead. And so something like Bitcoin is going to fit in nicely with that vision. So my idea is that, you know, democracies are going to bankrupt themselves and monarchies are going to be in much better shape. And then I think it's either that democracies are going to be taken over by monarchies, or the best scenario for them is to wake up and restore their domestic monarchs.
So here's a question: what do you think will come first? countries to adopt monarchy or countries adopt a Bitcoin standard? Or which one will lead to the other or the other way around?
I don't know. I think we're going to have a variety of experiences.
Yeah,
but I think basically, you know, strong, vibrant, functioning democracies that are really very good at being democratic are going to just keep doubling down on bread and circus and popularity contests and, you know, Elizabeth Warren kind of genius where we punish the producers and we hand out money to voters in our popularity contests. And I think at these places, we're going to witness just more and more doubling down on fiat and then more and more bankruptcies and just it's going to be very ugly. And then, I mean, you know, if these kind of countries have monarchy neighbors, then these monarchs might just step in and take over. But hopefully they'll just restore their own monarchs. I think that would be
smoother. I hope so too. Even in a parliamentary or constitutional monarchy, with a democracy, you still that's still a lot better than these republics. You see that, you know, list all the countries that are constitutional monarchy. You know, you've got Spain, Holland, Belgium, Norway, Sweden, Japan, United Kingdom, all of them have. I mean, there's others as well. The one thing they have in common is stability. Yes, they're not perfect. They've got problems with their democracies. But compare those to some of the other countries, other republics. Different. It's different. So at that point, you know, if you were to implement a monarchy, probably countries that are a republic right now that implement a monarchy will probably go with parliamentary, with constitutional monarchy first. I mean, I'm going to be realistic about this because when people when they describe absolute monarchies, they group them together with dictatorships. So it's sad, but that's what we have to do. But I think with time, people will start to realize if we, you know, make our argument known out there. But yeah, even with a parliamentary, so a constitutional monarchy does give that check on the democracy, on the government, not to do stupid things. And it's worked before at times. So yeah, that's still better than no monarchy.
Yes, I agree. In fact, there's been this study that was done by an economist called Guillen, Guillen. And he looked at 137 countries between the years 1900 and 2010. So that's 137 countries over 110 years. And he found monarchies tend to be dynasties and therefore have a long-term focus. If you focus on the long run, you are bound to be more protective of property rights. He found that monarchies are better protection, offer better protection for property rights. And also, I think most relevant to Bitcoiners, they had much lower inflation. Monarchies had lower inflation than republics. And I know from the example of Arab countries, a few years ago I did a study on this. And you look at Arab countries, I mean, they're culturally very similar countries, 20 of them. There's basically 10 republics and 8 monarchies. I looked at data for 18. 10 republics and 8 monarchies. And if you rank them by the degree of the devaluation of their currencies versus the US dollar, then you see that the ranking is split in half. All the monarchies had much lower inflation than all the republics without comparison. It isn't even close. All of the republics destroyed their currencies. Every single Arab republic has destroyed its currency. And I think pretty much all the republics over the world have destroyed their currency pretty much. I mean, there will be a few exceptions here and there. Switzerland has been on a gold standard pretty late, but I think the trend is unmistakable. Democracy leads to high time preference, leads to currency destruction. I don't think there's any escaping that. I think
no.
What Bitcoin introduces is a solution and a way out for people who live in those countries. So previously, it used to be that if you were in a country that gets taken over by fiat Democrats, they're going to destroy your wealth and you had no choice. Well, now they can destroy their wealth, destroy the people who like them and who trust them. But those who don't trust them can opt out. That's where I see the light at the end of the tunnel, that monarchs and their supporters will opt out with Bitcoin. And it'll just get easier because, you know, it's going to be the old easy money versus hard money story that I discuss in the Bitcoin Standard.
Mm. Yeah, finally, this Bitcoin's give me and many people hope. It's give me, mentioned this before, but it's as you said, light at the end of the tunnel. It's given meaning to our lives again. Before, everything was so abstract or ambiguous, really. Everything was really all over the place. Fiat money is abstract. Fiat money is ambiguous. Fiat money is everywhere. You know, it's not very rare that two economists can agree on the same principles. whereas with Bitcoin, as I said before, it's there. The protocol is there. You can see it. You can feel it, and it doesn't stop. It's as simple as what? It's a complex process, but it's as simple as 1 + 1 = 2, and you can't change that ever. And this is what really blew my mind, I guess. And what really helped me is that you can't stop Bitcoin. Bitcoin doesn't care. Bitcoin doesn't care about you. Bitcoin doesn't care about anyone else. And that's what's beautiful. When people get their heads around that, that is really what changes a lot. Because those 10 minutes, every 10 minutes, a new block is mine. Bam, over and over again. And you can't stop that. And that's beautiful.
Absolutely. It's really one thing in this world that can't be ruined by fiat. I think this is what it really comes down to. And I think the reason that Bitcoiners can be just such ruthless critical thinkers is that think about any other kind of setting. You know, think about the best universities in the world where they attract the smartest people in the world. All the smartest people in the world go to some of these universities. They meet there. There's very smart professors, very smart students. Somebody starts to think critically about something and they come up to a conclusion that is politically incorrect. Well, it doesn't matter how smart they are. It doesn't matter how good their conclusion is. If they come up with a conclusion that is, you know, such as, let's say, monarchy is better system than democracy. Like if you were at Harvard and you came up with something like this, it doesn't matter how smart you are. It doesn't matter how well you argue that position. It doesn't matter how much conviction you have, how much evidence you present. It doesn't matter. None of this matters. Ultimately, reality doesn't get imposed in that kind of fiat world by logic, by reality, by arguing, by intelligence. Reality flows from the top down, from the money printer downward. So it doesn't matter. Harvard is supposed to promote democracy. You go there and you talk about monarchy, you're going to have a bad time making it in your department. You're going to have a bad time getting funding for your next research proposal. You're going to have a bad time getting invited to the end of year parties with your colleagues. It's all of the money comes from above. All of the research grants are assigned from above. And it comes from the fiat money printer, which basically subverts reality. And you know, it doesn't have to be an example as controversial as monarchy and democracy. It can be something, even if it's something trivial, like let's say, for instance, biofuels. I use this example because that was what I was into in my graduate studies. If you come up with a question, if you come up with an answer that says, you know, we need alternative energy because that's how the world, is going to fix carbon dioxide, boiling the oceans, then, you know, you're going along with the groupthink, you're going along with the money printer, you can get more cash from the money printer and you can keep your job and you can get promoted and you can get more research grants and you can hire more graduate students to do slave work for you so that you can publish more and more and continue to try and shape reality with this ridiculous, insane narrative that we're going to replace hydrocarbon fuels with with corn and wind and sunshine. And that's how this narrative continues for 50 years. On the other hand, if you try and be just only slightly sane. Like, for instance, Alex Epstein, whom I've hosted several times on this podcast, a great writer, he has absolutely no place in the university system because he goes against the fiat money printer. And so there aren't any major university professors who can get famous or go to get good jobs at good departments who'll make the blatantly obvious case that we can't replace hydrocarbon fuels with sunshine, wind, corn, and angel farts, as people tend to think. And that just continues in the university. And that's why I think in Bitcoin, we see this restoration of natural order. We see it across everything. That's why Bitcoiners, all of the environmental hysteria, it is far more popular outside of Bitcoin circles than in Bitcoin circles. There are still, of course, a lot of hysterical Bitcoiners who think CO2 is going to boil the ocean, and I wish them best of luck reaching adulthood. But within Bitcoiners, the numbers are much smaller. And I think it's just once you're free from this fiat printer imposing reality from above, it becomes possible to think. And I think as Bitcoin spreads, we're going to see this more and more. And that's kind of my optimism on the issue of monarchy and democracy.
Yeah, that's great. You have to reach the approved, conclusions, basically, when you're in the fiat system.
Yes.
Otherwise, if you have any sort of critical thinking, it's yeah, you're not going to go far in the fiat world that way. You'll be censored.
Yeah. So you've moved to Belgrade. What are your plans there? How are we going to get the monarchy back?
Yeah, moved here just over a year and a half ago, and with my wife Danica and my son Stefan, and we. Ever since, so maybe go back to when I married my wife and had my son the year after in 2018, that woke me up a little. That just revived my monarchical duties. I guess I was just living in London, minding my own business, working my finance in finance, but then I realized when I married my wife, she's Serbian. That I got more in touch with my Serbian side. And I had my son. And when you have your son, you realize, oh my God, what world am I going to leave for him? Well, I have nothing really to give for him. That Serbia's in a bad shape. This world is pretty not great. I need to protect life for my son. So that really woke me up. And so I started getting more involved with things in Serbia. And as I said before, I have, because I'm a prince, I have a voice. The Kara Djordjevic family here, the Kara Djordjevic dynasty is very important to Serbia. Yes, there's a lot of propaganda that's gone against the Kara Djordjevics that was taught at school. They taught us that we went against the people, that we stole, we left the country with all the gold. And Yugoslavia, the disintegration, Yugoslavia is all King Alexander I of fault, but... That's just very short-sighted. It just doesn't hold up. And a lot of people are waking up to that. And as I said before, I have a voice and I want to do what's good. And I want to give other people the opportunity to speak out as well, to amplify their voices. And we want to travel Serbia and the region, meeting people, get to understand the problems. And I just want to work on things that are beneficial to Serbia. Like we want to start, for example, I want to start a foundation that works with promoting local businesses, making them do businesses that are good for the look good for locality. I guess that's the word. I'm not sure if that's the word, but. Also to work things that help the environment. There's a lot of stuff that's happening. There's a lot of pollution in the rivers. There was a big thing where Rio Tinto wanted to come and mine lithium of all things in Serbia and destroy the countryside there. And I'm not a supporter of that, but also not a supporter of electric vehicles in general, because they don't make much sense in my opinion. So anything to stop them getting more their hands on more lithium is a good thing, because this would have been one of the top top 10 biggest mines in the world. And that also is to do with the whole globalist idea. They didn't want to come here, and that money wasn't going to stay here. That money was going to leave the country. So we've got to do things that where the money stays here, the wealth stays here, and people are free to do what they want to over here. And on top of that, I want to work on cultural heritage projects. There's a lot of, for example, my road, I live right now. There's a beautiful villa just down the road that was recently destroyed because fiat problems, because someone bought the villa because it's worth a lot now because of the property prices have gone up because of the fiat problems. So they buy the house. They buy the house and then they want to destroy a beautiful villa from 1920 or 1934. Anyway, beautiful villa built in the king in the time of the kingdom. And then they want to destroy it and then build flats for purpose-built, you know, income generators. And yeah, that's not cool. And this happens quite corruptly when it happens. And this is not just one villa, there's many villas around that happens to. Just the day before yesterday, on Saturday, we went to visit a hotel, which was an old building palace of the Obrenovich dynasty, which is the other dynasty that came about here, the second uprising for Serbia. And this beautiful palace was then, back in the days, we had the Karadjordjevic family have a connection to it because they helped to restore it. I think I forgot the date, but I say 100 years ago. But then recently, it was burnt like from the inside out. Not you can still see the outside. Some of the roof has collapsed, but this was done on purpose, basically, because they have a lot of people here destroying what's cultural, what the identity of Serbia and Yugoslavia. And I want to change that. I want to make people proud of being Serb. A lot of people have left the country because of the economical disasters of the last 70 years, but also because of their political ideologies. A lot of the monarchists are actually all around the world. You have so many diasporas all around the world. The biggest is in Canada, then you have in America, Germany, Australia, the UK. You have big communities there. And I want to tell them that it's okay to come back to Serbia. It's okay to not speak the language like myself, and I'm learning it. That you can come back without learning, you can learn the language here, and people will be very open arms to you. And this, we don't want this demographical suicide to continue, where people are leaving this huge brain drain. And they say that Serbia does still have opportunities, and Serbia has a lot of potential. So you come here, and you not only will you be helping the country, but you can also make a good life here because of the potential aspect of it as well. There's a lot of things I want to focus on here, but yeah, it's exciting times. But then on top of that, there's Bitcoin. side by side is Bitcoin. When I discovered Bitcoin, when I figured out that Bitcoin, it's all about Bitcoin, that I think that Bitcoin can go hand in hand with helping Serbia and the region out. Then I want to start doing projects with Bitcoin here. Maybe on my foundation is to have a section of Bitcoin education, help people with to get jobs to do with Bitcoin. Maybe there's a lot of tech orientated minds here. There's very mathematical brains in Serbia, so maybe the development side could spring up as well. And maybe I don't know, help companies get their treasuries onto Bitcoin, and maybe even start saving programs with Bitcoin as well. These ideas I'm floating around now, but I think that Serbia has there's a space for that here in Serbia, and hopefully rush it towards the Bitcoin standard as soon as possible.
Yeah, I mean, I'm guessing you have no interest in running for office, parliament or anything like that, do you?
No, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, politics I'll leave out.
I think this is an excellent example of what I was discussing, that you know, you have all these goals about how you'd like to make Serbia better, but they're not they would not get you elected, but you don't care. And you know, if you compare your agenda to the average Serbian politician, they're probably far more of a short-term kind of focus on the agenda. You know, let's boost government revenue by having Rio Tinto come and destroy the countryside so that they can make Teslas and electric vehicles for us. You know, it'll boost the government coffers. Like, this is how people get elected. You come in with that plan. You say, we're going to bring this, we're going to spend money, we're going to build, you know, we're going to hand out money to people for all kinds of popular ideas. Well, how are you going to finance it? Oh, I'm going to let this company come and mine. And the company will mine and, you know, it'll destroy the countryside for centuries, but it'll boost government revenue for 5 years, during which this guy is in office, during which time he can win a lot of elections and help his supporters and punish his enemies. And it's refreshing to see somebody take this kind of long-term perspective. I see this in Jordan, for instance, where you have the democratic politics and you have the politicians and the ministers that are fighting over day-to-day stuff. And then you have the monarchy that has a very long-term vision for the country. And they think in really long term. And if you, you know, one of my favorite examples to illustrate the value of monarchy is to just compare Jordan to its neighbors. You look at what happened to Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Palestinians over the last century, without a monarch, without the king, without the Hashemites. These places are in very, very deep trouble today. I think I'd invite skeptical listeners to look at examples of this in their own neighborhood, in their own part of the world, and look at, you know, try and clear out the democratic propaganda that you've heard about how all the kings are evil and all of the glorious military leaders are glorious and well-intentioned, although sometimes they can be uncomfortably genocidal and mass murdering, but we still excuse that for them. Just look at the currency, you know, compare the national currencies of monarchies to, you know, pick any monarchy compared to its nearby republics and see.
You pointed this out. And one thing is that monarchies don't want to engage in war. Well, it's against their interest to start war. Whereas with a democracy, you get some crazy leader, some stupid leader that wants to get into a stupid project or of getting to war for his popularity and to raise money with the contracts that go along with war. It's, you know, with the war machine, I guess. So monarchies don't want to get involved in wars like that because it's not good for them. Because if they do something wrong, they're not gonna last, and then their family lineage is done, it's gone. So it's in the interest for peace and stability.
Yeah,
you can't really argue against that, really.
Yeah, I mean, the century of central banking and democracy was the century of world wars and endless conflict and just interminable wars. There's always this idea that we live in peace if you just ignore all the genocides and wars that have taken place and take them out of the data and you look at selective periods of time, then yeah, this is the most peaceful period of time ever. But I think the evidence really points to the contrary of this. And I think, you know, in the case of a monarchy, the king will carry the responsibility himself, his bloodline, his children forever. You know, if you mess up a war, you are in trouble. Whereas in the case of democracy, there's actually a positive incentive to get into war because war allows you to suppress local opposition. You know, all the local opposition become traitors. And then you can just suppress them. And it's a way for insecure presidents to try and secure their rule and lengthen their rule to launch conflicts. And so you see this in many cases where these republics just start picking fights with their neighbors. And also, you know, part of it is just that the leaders themselves, they become megalomaniac. You know, they're not blue-blooded. They haven't been, you know, they haven't been raised in a family with several generations of history of being in charge, so they don't have this kind of restraint of the father and the grandfather and the uncles who've always told you, you know, keep a long-term perspective on things. So they, you know, you get somebody like Saddam Hussein at Iraq, in Iraq, who just got so megalomaniacal about the fact that he had so much power and money. He invaded Iran, he invaded Kuwait, and really the Iraqis are paying for that until today. You know, before the insane revolution of Iraq, Iraq had the Hashemites. And under the Hashemites, who are currently the same ruling family of Jordan, you know, it was the cousin of the king of Jordan, was the king of Iraq. And under the Hashemites, Iraq was stable. It was peaceful. It had good relations with its neighbors. It wasn't launching wars. And had they stayed under the Hashemites, I am 100% confident there would not have been an Iran-Iraq war. And Iraq would be in a very different place than what it is today.
Mm. Yeah, I completely agree.
So, are you familiar with the work of Prince Hans Adam of Liechtenstein? He wrote this book, The State in the Third Millennium.
I haven't, actually. No, I haven't read it. I've heard of it, but I haven't read it. I know that, you know, we talked about Liechtenstein is it can go very well. Liechtenstein is basically speaking about Bitcoin without speaking about Bitcoin.
So, that's true. So
yeah, but you said they do maybe hold some Bitcoin, but haven't gone really public about it. So it's great. Sorry, more about this book. Tell me.
Yeah, I mean, Prince Hans Adam, who's the Prince of Liechtenstein currently, he wrote this book, which I think is an incredibly important book. And if we weren't in a fake fiat world, this would be one of the most important books taught in political science departments today. But I don't think I haven't heard of a single university that teaches it. I'm sure there must be someone somewhere doing it, but very few. But he makes the case for monarchy in the third millennium. And I think it's a pretty original case, and it's a very compelling case. And his idea is that we should move away from thinking of government as a monopoly and to think of government in a competitive sense. Government needs to compete for its subject. And it's less confrontational to democracy. It argues a position that can, I think, be accepted more by Democrats. And perhaps I should tone down my anti-democratic rhetoric and accommodate him, because what he says is the right for democracy is the right for self-determination and is the right of secession. And in his idea, kings and monarchs should be like service providers, and local communities can decide to either join a monarch and be part of their constituency, or break away and become independent, or join another country and join another constituency. And it's a pretty free market model for government. You know, we keep hearing about different ways in which, you know, you want to make government more competitive. I think Prince Hans Adam has really hit the nail on the head in this, in presenting it. That so this is how they run it in Liechtenstein. So I think it was in 2004, where they had a referendum in Liechtenstein where essentially the people voted to give the Prince of Liechtenstein more executive power at the expense of the parliament. And the idea was that they would get this right of self-determination. So it's like you sign up for a CEO, but you can sign out, you can check out anytime you want. And so any part of Liechtenstein can choose to become independent anytime it wants, or it can choose to join Austria or Switzerland, the neighboring countries. And they are part of Liechtenstein because they want to be part of Liechtenstein. And Liechtenstein is a tiny country, but this is a model that I think scales because essentially all the tiny hamlets of Liechtenstein, which are small little villages, people in those hamlets, they vote to be part of Liechtenstein by majority of the inhabitants. And at any point in time, if they don't like being part of Liechtenstein, they can vote it out. So this gets rid of the dysfunction of democracy and the fact that, you know, you have to have everybody agree and you have to have people debate and everybody wants to vote and everybody wants to be in power. You get rid of that by giving more executive power to the prince. and the you know, it's and then you just have the right to exit. So it's similar to how you get, you know, how why do you get a good laptop? It's not because you have an executive power in the laptop company. You don't go to Apple and you tell them, hey, I'd like you to do this and do that. You're offered the product, and if you buy it, you get it. If you don't want like it, you go to the competitor. And this is what keeps all laptop makers constantly in competition with one another and improving their products, because they have to compete to win their customers. And this is effectively what Prince Hans Adam is suggesting, that the model should be that people choose out of self-determination to join princes and kings, and the best princes and the best kings will succeed in attracting more and more communities to join them. And I think, I suspect within a few decades, we're likely to begin to see parts of Austria and Switzerland, you know, particularly after the last couple of years when Austria and Switzerland became, you know, just another COVID shithole, locking people up because of respiratory illnesses. I think we might see parts of these countries decide to vote to join Liechtenstein. It'll be interesting to see how Austria and Switzerland react to this.
I had to read that book. It's fun. It's fascinating. Yeah, no, I've heard great things about the prince there, but yeah, and I've heard about that book as well, but didn't realize the way you explained it. It's a must read.
Yeah, it's a great book, and he's a great intellect. I think he's obviously he doesn't get given a lot of attention because, you know, we live in a democratic propaganda age, but I think it's very fascinating, and it might be useful for you in your restoration efforts.
Yes, thanks.
Excellent. All right, Stefano has a question for you.
Thank you, Saif, and thank you, Prince Philip. It's been very interesting to listen to you.
Thanks.
So actually, I have two questions. The first one, I'm curious to know if you have any relationship with other monarchs in the area, such as, I believe, Prince Nikolai from Romania or the monarchic family in Bulgaria. That's the first. And the second, you mentioned that you live in London for a long time and you recently moved to back to Serbia, to your home country. I'm curious to know what's your observation? What did you notice? What was your experience in going from west to east?
Sure. So relations with other monarchies, other royal families. Well, firstly, my mother is from a member of royal family as well. She's Brazilian royalty. She's from the Orleans Braganza dynasty. So there's Brazilian, Portuguese, French roots in there, and my father. I mean, my father. There's her mother was from Greece. So there's, I'm guess some pure blue blood when it comes to that way. So there's a lot. I'm a big mix. But the monarchy with the royals today, I have good connections with decent. I mean, good connections. Yeah, with for example, my father has connections with the Romanians, and it's been they've come to Belgrade a few times. I've met a few times with the Greek royal family as well. The Spanish, of course, I have relationship with that. I was at he's the king now, King Felipe's wedding in 2004. I have good friends in with the Belgium princess, and also I actually know someone from Liechtenstein, where one of the Liechtenstein members of the royal family, young, but not from the head branch. So yeah, this I do know a few royalty, not maybe as much as I would have done if I was more in a more functioning, in a functioning, in a if. The monarch, if our monarchy was a functioning monarchy. Also, I should mention that Queen Victoria is a friend, and she's also was the best woman to my wife at a wedding.
So yeah, you should try orange peel some of them.
Yeah, that's the idea now.
Good, that's great.
And the other question, to answer the other question, was that moving from London to Serbia has been a big eye opener. I think Serbia is a great place to be, where it has a good balance between East and West. Mm-hmm. And I was more brainwashed in London, living in the UK, and coming to Serbia, you know, you see, you see things differently. And that also came along the time when I was, when I became a Bitcoin maxi. Serbs have gone through a lot of crap in the last 70 years, and especially now, the more recently, with the wars that broke up, that tore apart Yugoslavia, the bombings, the 1999 NATO bombings, which was just disastrous, really. That Serbs are now, you know, now you the West thing, or you know, the East are all propaganda machine, being all influenced by the propaganda machine. Maybe so during the communist years, but not anymore. Now it's the other way around. Serbia and the region is very aware of this propaganda that's happening in the Western world, and they know, they see it, and they talk about it. So it's a great place. It's a great place to be on that side.
Thank you, Vince Filo. That's very
thanks. Thanks, Stefan.
Nathan, you have a question.
Yeah, sir, thank you for your time. This has been very interesting. I wonder if you could give a perspective or a sense of the feedback you get since you've publicly started talking about Bitcoin, like from colleagues, business associates, other politicians. Are you getting any taps on the shoulder suggesting you shouldn't do that, or encouragement?
Good question. That hasn't actually filtered through to the fiat world so much. My work haven't got back to me yet. I'm not such a big figure in my work. I'm more sort of middle rank, I should say. So I'm not too client facing and all that. So I mean, you can't, if you search for me and my work, you won't see that Prince Philip works at my company. So it hasn't filtered through yet. That's the work side. Although I'm quite scared, I'm not scared, but I'm waiting for it to happen, because I've spoken about a few things like ESG. I've called out on, and I actually work with ESG. Part of my work has to do with ESG as well. So, hey, you know, at least I'm being honest. But with politicians, not yet. I mean, hopefully the idea would be that I'll be able to speak to politicians about it and engage with them, to educate them to anything to speed up the Bitcoin adoption. So yeah, I mean, the only reaction that I think is great is mainly the reaction I've had from the Bitcoin community, which is incredible. And it's very, very warming to have that reaction. And I have had some reaction within the Serbian community on my Twitter. You get some people saying, you know, people don't understand Bitcoin, saying, you know, what, you know, the prince is going crazy and things like that. But that was expected.
Yeah, I mean, the haters will hate.
They really will.
Part of existence. Anytime you want to do anything worthwhile, you're going to get people's knickers in a twist. That's just par for the course. Actually, could you tell us a little bit more about your experiences in fiat finance? I heard you on Daniel's podcast, and we're going to post the link, where you you called ESG as enriching sick globalists. What drives you to such extremist conclusions? I mean, why do you hate BlackRock and Vanguard? Why shouldn't they be able to make trillions of dollars from selling CO2? Sounds like such a brilliant idea.
I mean, I don't work for those two, luckily. But it's like CO2. How do you price that? What does that actually mean? You know, CO2 is everywhere. CO2 is a... contrary to what people are saying, that CO2 is actually fundamental to life as well. We need CO2 for living organisms to survive. Yes, you can have too high CO2, but also you can have too low CO2, and the world has gone through through cycles that CO2 has been high millennia, I should say, millions of years ago, but also it's gone too low for life as well to exist. So going back to finances, it creates a big confusion. No one knows how to price it. And on top of that, it just creates a new market, which is based on thin air, I guess, that it's just another way of making money. And this goes with the... It's just a new repackaged way of making money that's just And I've seen it grow since I first started working in finance, and especially working writing RFPs, requests for proposals. I talked about it in Daniel's show, that I saw the question of ESG growing all the time. There's more talk about ESG, so that obviously caught my attention. But then when I moved into my new team, it's not new anymore, and I started actually working on some ESG projects, and I started to see right through it, basically. And a lot of it, it's just checking boxes and greenwashing and anything to make yourself look good, to satisfy the investor that is interested to try and save, inverted brackets, the planet. And this doesn't make much sense to me. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's... In the previous episode, a couple of episodes ago, we hosted Tom Nelson, who's a terrific independent researcher who's been looking into this for a very long time. And I think, you know, obviously, if you have a shred of critical thinking, you can't but help realize there's just an enormous amount of unsubstantiated conclusions being reached by the kind of people who think that this is really a crisis and that it is going to destroy the world. But then you see the flip side is, you know, when people who have experience with the financial world, you see just how much money there is to be made from this hysteria, from keeping people scared about it, and then from trading it. And that just the idea of carbon trading initially sounds, you know, it seems like such a neat market solution. Oh, you know, instead of just subsidizing and taxing different energy sources, we should just place a tax on carbon. And that will allow the market to figure out the best way to reduce carbon emissions. And this was kind of this was the conclusion of, I'm ashamed to say it, my PhD at a Fiat university, that subsidizing energy sources is a bad idea. It's central planning, but placing a carbon tax, well, that's much better, because now you're going to let the market decide. But in reality, all that you're doing is just creating a market where essentially BlackRock gets to basically decide what is CO2, who gets to emit CO2, how much they get to emit, and, you know, what qualifies as environmentally friendly and what does not, and then they trade based on that. So you're separating business operations from profit and loss, and just moving the customer away from being the one who decides who's creating value and who's not creating value, and then just letting a bunch of bureaucrats decide this for everyone.
Yeah, and the rating providers for ESGs that we use to help build our models, they also contradict with each other as well. You know, I think they give an example with that, like one company gives Tesla like a AAA because, you know, electric cars, but the other company gives it a CCC because it mines lithium in very questionable, horrible ways. So they can't even make up their minds on that one.
Yeah, and it is subjective, and it's entirely subjective, and this is why these things are just a backdoor for central planning to come in. You know, who's going to decide whether we care more about CO2 in the atmosphere or lithium in the water and destroying the Serbian countryside? What do you care more about? You know, obviously for people in Serbia, they care more about their countryside being destroyed, but for the rest of us, well, who cares about Serbia anyway? So maybe we should be caring more about CO2 in the atmosphere. So it's obviously ridiculous. And there's no way of, you know, the free market answer for this is property rights. The people who own land can decide if they want to dig for lithium in it. And the people who don't own the land don't get to make that choice. And by bringing in these essentially central planners to provide ratings and criteria, you're just allowing them to play king.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, Stefano has another question for you.
Yes, thank you, Saif. And Prince Philip, I'm curious to know, I know that Serbia applied to join the European Union. I believe they are on the list of candidate countries.
Yes.
But they're not been granted membership yet.
No.
What's your opinion about that? Do you think would be a positive development if Serbia joins the EU or not?
My opinion would be it's going to piss off a few of the progressives here, but no, I don't think it's a very good idea. I think the European Union is a bit of a disaster, really. I think the European Union should have stopped at just being an open economical area. When it became too political, then, and especially now with, well, not now, it's been going on for 20 years now, the euro, absolute disaster. It's just another centralization with a centralization. I mean, this is centralization squared, really. It's not a great idea. I think that Serbia will stand to do better if they have better economic ties with their neighbors, and you know, open to commerce that way. Which, I mean, they are, but you know, joining the European Union is just another way of just conceding more power and more control over to something that's not working.
Yeah, I think many of us here agree with you. And what do you think about the? I mean, since you left London very recently and Britain and England left the European Union 4 or 5 years ago, how is the situation been in England? Is it better since they left the European Union? What's your assessment of that?
Worse because of the distraction that everyone's getting under, really. But I think on the long term, it'll be better.
Okay.
You know, I was at the beginning, I was not for Europe, England leaving for Britain leaving for Brexit, but then that's because I was getting a bit more brainwashed. But now, obviously, I see the positives of it. Yes, there's going to be short term consequences, but then the long term benefits are going to much outweigh that. You know, really, I always did see the arguments on both sides, but I always think that maybe if England stayed, if Britain stayed in the EU, they could help to enact change. By being inside, but no, I mean, I think the best thing is for it to break up.
Thank you, Prince Philip.
Thanks.
Finally, I don't know much about Yugoslavian politics and Yugoslavian history. I don't claim to be an expert, but I've always been very strongly opposed to the partitioning of Yugoslavia for the very simple reason that I think a Yugoslavian national team in football would be an absolutely amazing thing to watch. So I remember in 1990, they had an amazing team and they lost to Argentina on penalties in the World Cup. And I was, you know, I hated Argentina because I was a Brazilian fan. I'd lived in Brazil and Argentina eliminated Brazil. And then Yugoslavia came very close to eliminating Brazil, to eliminating Argentina. And then Argentina won. And since then, I've had a soft spot for them. Then they were kicked out of the European Championship in 92. And then they were split up into many countries. And I might be the only person in the world who supports all Yugoslavian teams when they go to national championships. Croatia in 1998, I was very happy to see them do this. And then in 2016, again,
it's incredible what they did.
Yeah, and I think in 1998 they would have probably won the World Cup if they were, you know, if you added to the Croatians made the semifinals. So if you added a few Serbian and Slovenian and the rest of the players, correct, I think they would have probably been good enough to win the World Cup. So this is my bias, but I know obviously there are other considerations that people who live there might have. But what are your thoughts on this? Like, do you think Yugoslavia should be one country, or do you believe in self-determination for the people of all of these nations? Or do you think smaller, ethnically and religiously homogenous kingdoms or principalities is a better arrangement?
I think maybe that's what you left said, is the latter is the best arrangement today, because it's more decentralized. But of course, I was a fan of Yugoslavia, not because of the football, but because of because of the kingdom and how prosperous and how well the people lived under the kingdom. So, but nowadays, I think the world is different, and I think we're figuring out that this decentralization is better for communities. But at the same time, I don't support any more decentralization. What's happening in Serbia is with Kosovo being independent. Well, I mean, I don't recognize it as being independent, but I think Serbia will be fine to stay as it is. But it's important to create strong relations to further their strong relations with their neighbors. and to you know, anything to put to help the locals prosper, but not go overboard with any sort of globalist ideologies.
Yeah, sadly, we're just going to have to see them play in different teams, but it's okay.
Yeah. I mean, we do have a decent team that beat Portugal to reach the finals this year. So
That's true.
Yeah. North Macedonia beat Italy to now play Portugal in the playoff. So that was quite big.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's very impressive how, and it's not just in football. The former Yugoslavians are just so good at all sports. It's amazing. And basketball, handball, they dominate everything. They're up there with the best water polo. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anna is a Serbian living in the UK, and she has a question for you. Anna, you want to go ahead?
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Can you hear me okay? Yeah.
I can hear you.
I can speak in English, I guess. Yeah. Serbian is.
Please. Yeah.
Okay. Right. So I live in up in Scotland, and I was just really curious about the projects that you were mentioning in terms of starting Bitcoin projects in Belgrade or Serbia. So I wonder where I can find a bit more about this. And
this is still ideas floating, I said, but this is something I definitely want to do. And I'll need to pick the minds of people like you and people like Safe and the community to see what I can do. I had one idea is to make a Bitcoin education page on my website, which hasn't been released yet, my website. So I need to work on that. But the ideas would be maybe start a pension scheme for just Bitcoin only pension scheme that invests directly into Bitcoin and not exposure to Bitcoin. And the other thing would be, I mean, I personally want to start some business on my own, but I haven't figured that quite out yet, but it will be Bitcoin related. But also to convince companies to join them, to get Bitcoin on their treasuries and projects like that. So I'm open to ideas. I'm open to suggestions. And that's something I'm really excited about. Yeah.
Yeah, great. So where can I find a bit more about this? Or is it you have a page? Or?
Not yet. We're almost completed our website. I haven't started a Bitcoin page, but that's more of a very recent idea. And I guess if you follow me on Twitter, I'll release it on my Twitter, but I'll have it circulated in other places as well.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Hala.
Okay, well, keep us posted on all of these developments. We'd be happy to share it with our listeners. I know many Serbians all over the world who tune in, and I look forward to seeing you in Miami in a couple of weeks. You're going to be joining us for the carnivore dinner there.
Yes, hopefully. I have some passport issue, but I'll hopefully get there.
Yes. I can't believe even royals have to deal with this passport nonsense.
Yep.
Okay, well, Prince Philip, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been absolutely fascinating.
I
enjoyed this.
It's been an absolute pleasure to be here. Really, really exciting.
Thank you. All right. Well, we'll definitely stay in touch, and we'll definitely have you here again and to catch up, and hopefully, you know, with a full monarchist restoration in Serbia next time.
I would love that. Yeah. That would be great. Thanks again. It's been so much fun as well. And thank you as well to the attendees. Really. Thank you so much. I had a good chat with you guys earlier. So great to meet you all.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Take care. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.